Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016. With me today, I have John Martellaro. And how are you, John?
I am very good. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Also great to have Adam Christensen from the MacCast. How are you doing, Adam?
Hey, I'm doing good.
Awesome. It's a we do the iOS show together every weekend. It's fun to get to do other shows together too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I enjoy this. Yeah. So we have a couple things that I really want to make sure we hit today. So we should jump right in. And the first thing that I feel we are pretty much compelled to talk about is the Senate, the House Judiciary Committee hearing from yesterday on encryption. And this is the hearing where FBI Director James Comey testified, as did Apple's Senior Vice President and General Counsel Bruce Sewell, and there were a couple other people as well, and I feel horrible because I just suddenly drew a blank on names. One is an amazing professor from, I believe
Susan Landau.
Thank you, Susan Landau from Worcester University.
Yep.
And then the other is Cyrus Vance. He is the New York District Attorney for Manhattan. You have no idea how much it hurt to pull those names from my head. So Director Comey and District Attorney Vance were arguing that access to our encrypted data is critical for law enforcement, and and then the other side of the argument we have, of course, is that this is a really bad thing. So this ended up being a 5-hour long hearing. I sat through the whole thing. Seriously.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm curious, what do you guys think?
Well, my first reaction was the disagreement about whether the NSA had the technical ability to go ahead and get everything out of this phone that they wanted. And I sensed a little bit of tension there about NSA wanting to keep that quiet, not necessarily wanting to reveal that they have that. It's perhaps classified information. There's some restrictions on whether they could admit it, whether Comey could admit it, whether if Comey went to the NSA, whether they would give him the tools, or whether Comey said, well, if you give us the tools, then the defense would have to get the tools. Maybe we should just make a fuss about it, do it our own way, see if Apple would cave. There was a lot of underlying nuances, conflicting information, possible classified data. That was my first reaction to it.
You're saying you don't believe him when he says that the NSA doesn't have tools that could help them?
No, I don't believe him. I've had some encounters with NSA people in my Apple days, and those guys are good. They're so good. They're scary good. And I would give it a 90% chance that the NSA could do what the FBI can't.
Well, Susan Landau agrees with you, John.
Yeah, that was part of the surprise that.
Do we think they actually have tools, like, in terms of, I mean, we know the FBI's thing is, hey, we want to crack the passcode, right? So do they have tools that are going to be any different than what's already been proposed by a number of security people, which is the whole decapping technique?
I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with it. It's just that my gut instinct tells me they have some techniques, but as to specifics of how they do it in light of what we know,
right,
and what the FBI needs in terms of circumventing the timeouts and the 10 failed attempts, I don't know.
Well, I did like Ms. Landau's comment that she made. The FBI needs to take a page from the NSA.
Yeah, that was probably a bit of an embarrassment for the FBI.
Oh, sure. I mean, I found it interesting the way Director Comey conducted himself during the discussion, because he had a different demeanor than he had when he was speaking publicly about the issues. And he came across much calmer and far more level-headed, I felt, during the hearing. Although he did say, "I don't know," a lot.
Yeah, he's kind of run into a buzzsaw. I don't think he was anticipating the enormity of the number of organizations and people who would be weighed against him, and the technical ability of the people who would be involved in the discussion on both sides.
I
don't think he was prepared for that, and that's why he's changing his perspective as he goes along.
Yeah, which is good. And he was speaking very respectfully. Of Apple. So that was really good. I liked that. That made him seem more credible and more reasonable than he has sounded previously. But I have to say, watching Daryl Issa, he's a congressman from California, basically flay Director Comey with his questions that was something to behold. Regardless of which side of this issue you land on, that was something to watch. A congressman who has an understanding of technology and security, and he just went one after another with questions and comments at Director Comey. And James Comey just continued to say, "I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't think I understand the question."
Let me respond to that, Jeff.
Okay.
As you know, I spent most of my career working in either the military or the government, mostly government-related work. And my experience is that high-level directors are fed information and upward so that they can speak for the organization. But the higher you go in the organization, the less technical depth is. So there's this continuous spectrum from deep technical ability into management. And as you go up the ladder, those people who are more and more qualified to speak for the organization and less fully technically deep on the issues that they're responsible for talking about. And so you can go into a briefing room and the engineers or the analysts can talk to you right and left and give you briefing papers and provide you with outlines and coach you and everything. But ultimately, when the pressure's on and you're in front of a congressman, you may not have the academic and other technical training to be able to put into perspective the questions that are being asked of you. And so you kind of have to depend on the script you were given. Now, that varies amongst executives. You know, I've seen senior level directors who are very, very good and scary good. Mm-hmm. By and large, most of the government people are chosen for their management skills, their ability to handle people and money and project and so on. So you've got to remember, when you're watching these kinds of hearings, Comey is not a PhD in computer science. He's a FBI director. Mm-hmm. And so he can only bring to bear so much knowledge of it. And he's growing. It looks like he's growing by leaps and bounds in his awareness of the technical issues. But that's probably why he had to say, "I don't know," so often. It's not because he's dumb.
Oh, true. And I wasn't trying to imply that he is a dumb person, because you can't be dumb and do everything that he has and rise to the level that he's at. He has to be a very smart man. But it was just fascinating to watch this rapid fire succession of comments and questions. It was clear he did not know the answers to many of those questions. It made for quite a spectacle to watch. Yeah. So another thing that came out of the hearing that I thought was really interesting was when Bruce Sewell, Apple's general counsel, said that within an hour of the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 going down and disappearing, Apple was working with telephone providers all around the world to try and see if they could pick up a ping from any of the iPhones on that flight as a way to help locate where the plane was.
I remember hearing about that on the news. I don't think that was a revelation. I think it was just an affirmation.
You know, it may very well have been an affirmation, but it was new to me. And I just thought that was a very interesting thing and a very cool thing that Apple would have been in a position where they could start actively looking for pings from people's iPhones. And wouldn't that have been amazing if Apple had been able to pick up a location and then that had been a way to find the still missing flight?
Yeah, I think the problem is that the water was pretty deep where they think the plane went down.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to pick much of signal up when an iPhone is in, 2,000 or 3,000 meters of water?
Right. Yeah, at that point, the iPhone's just not working.
Yeah.
But, you know, if there had been floating debris and an iPhone was in that floating debris, like in someone's bag, then you know, maybe they could have located something that way. But no.
Yeah.
No. All right, so what was your just overall feeling about the hearings from yesterday?
Well, I didn't get a chance to watch it like you did, so I had to rely on after-action reports. But from what I've seen and what I've heard, I think we're moving into a phase of a very fruitful and helpful discussion about the issue. At first, it seemed like the government wanted to just bowl its way through this and get a court order and just by force, just, you know, make it happen. And as time has gone on, the situation has become better diagnosed, better analyzed. And now we're in a different phase where each side is better briefed, more aware of the public pressure, more aware of the issues at hand. And I sort of think the tide is swinging towards Apple.
Yeah, the overall raised public awareness is, I think, fortunately, the good outcome of all of this, regardless of what happens in this individual case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that the larger discussion, and I think that's something that, you know, probably both parties wanted ultimately. It's weird how it had to come about with this one incident, but I think overall it's a good thing.
I agree. And I was quite surprised at how many of the congressmen, congresspeople, had at least a rudimentary understanding of the technological issues here. And that was a very pleasant surprise.
Yeah. I mean, at the root level, I think, again, that's another good reason or a good thing that this has now sort of been brought to light, because you can talk to people and the underlying issues are pretty simple, right? Mm-hmm. Despite the technology, despite all of the terminology and stuff like that, when you get down to the issues of privacy and balancing that with security and protection, I think most people can at a root level understand that and they get it.
I think one of the other things that helped Adam was the New York judge's ruling, 35 pages or so, which was pretty strong. And if any of the congressmen had time to read that, they got a sort of a briefing statement on this, on the issues.
Right. But and again, I mean, as you guys were alluding to earlier, these people are smart people. It's just they deal with so much information, and they only deal with the information, as you were talking about earlier, John, that's currently in front of them, that's sort of passed up to them. And with this issue being so prominent in the past couple of weeks, it's not surprising that they would have been, you know, at least briefed at a very, you know, basic level, if not even a little bit more than that, on the technical issues and things like that. So, I mean, it's front of mind right now. So And again, they're smart people, but you can only process what's sort of in front of you at any given moment. And sure. So oftentimes when, you know, you see stuff that is brought up where they're not prepared or haven't been briefed, you know, that's when you get the, I don't know, I need to look into it sort of responses. And that's all anybody can really reasonably do. So.
Sure. Yeah. It was an interesting event to watch, and I'm glad that I watched it because I really needed to see the reactions that and stances that different people were taking on this. I'm glad I watched it, but man, 5 hours, I don't want to watch it again. Yeah, I know we could keep talking about this, but I said there's another topic that I really want to hit today, so I'm just going to move us on. And Adam, you brought this up, and this is the dilemma that that app developers are facing right now.
Well, I think, yeah, and it's not just app developers, it's all of us. It's really our community, and I guess that's where sort of my interest in this topic comes into play, and it's the ongoing sustainability of app development, especially in the iOS economy. But I mean, it's even starting now to filter back into the Mac store economy. And, you know, where are we going to be 10 years from now with having utilities and photo editing apps, you know, stuff that are beyond games for our devices, especially as our devices become more and more, you know, smartphones and tablets.
Right. And the problem we're facing right now seems to be that we have app developers that are looking at an economy or a system that doesn't seem to be sustainable for, many of these developers.
Yeah, I think sustainability is really the issue at the core of it, and there's issues on all sides. So a lot of times you see the blame being thrown back at Apple, and I've done it myself, in sort of creating an economy that forces a race to the bottom sort of pricing. Or you might turn to app developers saying, well, you're forcing this, you know, 99-cent free pricing model. But and I think this is all stuff that was being naturally led to. I don't know that it's any of that. I think some of the bigger issues are more about consumer attitudes and also app developers needing to recognize that, yes, the parameters have changed with selling software, and understanding the business parameters a little bit better and the marketing parameters. I think that's where developers need to spend a little more time and effort. You know, it's no longer good enough to have, you know, some great software developers and some great coders and a great idea. Those are all important elements. And in the early days of the App Store, you could kind of just get by with that. You could put together a really innovative, well-designed, well-programmed app, sell it for a buck or two, and sell lots of copies and do very, very well. And then maybe hopefully get, you know, bought up by a big guy or consumed by someone larger. But as more and more of that has happened, what we're starting to see is this divide where you have very large companies, very large game developers. You have Facebook and Apple. One of the stats I read, and I think this was based on Comscore data, is that Facebook and Google represent a large portion of sort of the top apps on the App Store now, the top, you know, sort of downloaded and selling apps.
You know, one of the things that concerns me a little bit about this, Adam, is could Apple have analyzed, based on the structure of the App Store, whether this was going to happen? Two, would it have produced a result that would have brought concern to Apple about the viability of the smaller developers? Three, is Apple worried about the structure of the store and some of the developers who are not doing well? Four, does there need to be any changes? And five, is Apple too focused on the idea that they paid out $40 billion to developers since the App Store opened?
Right.
And that they have this public number that suits them nicely?
To answer, I don't think Apple is concerned about this at all. I think, yeah, that number is something that they can throw around, and it looks really, really good for them. I don't, you know, I think they, and rightly so, I don't think this is a wrong attitude to take. They've created a marketplace, and it's up for the players in that marketplace to figure out, you know, it's not Apple's job to help a developer run a successful company. It's Apple's job to run a successful company that they already have, which is Apple.
Yeah, but Apple could have constructed the App Store finances and policies in such a way that it skewed it some in some direction, but maybe they've chosen not to.
Well, that's not their place. I mean, right. in a free market economy, I don't think that is their place. Now, they do have a vested interest in making sure that the tools and the platform and the everything is attractive to developers, and there's been no sign that that's not happening. So from Apple's perspective, I would think they would see the App Store economy as still something very, very, very healthy for their company. I mean, they're still getting developers, you know, coming to iOS first.
Sure.
They still have, you know, there's been no slowdown of apps being submitted to the App Store.
Right. And WWDC is packed every year.
That's true.
So, they're not having a problem. And they're perfectly fine if Facebook and Google are 8 out of the 10 most used apps on a phone. And that's what that number was from ComScore. So what's happening, though, is I think a lot of it is, too, for developers, it's a maturing of the product. Just as Apple is seeing a slowdown in sales of actual iPhones, or a leveling off, developers are also seeing that. And consumers, because there's so many apps in the App Store, they've sort of found those two or three key apps that they use on a regular basis, and they're willing to pay for those. And a lot of those, again, are coming from the bigger developers. And sort of the app of the day sort of market is still there, where a lot of developers will have a peak, but then they're seeing really steep drop-offs. So what we're left with is, you know, how does a indie developer, a small developer, sustain in this market? And a lot of them are turning to, say, the subscription model, which is interesting to watch. But for me as a consumer, that model is becoming more and more extended. My wallet is becoming extended.
Sure. Yeah, it eventually becomes a burden on us.
There's so many subscriptions that I can pay for, even if they're cheap, even if it's $1, $2, $3 a month. My filter starts to become more, which means I'm looking at less apps, I'm buying less apps, and that creates its own little issue for a developer trying to create a sustainable business for a 3-4-10 person company. You know, and this isn't an issue on either end, I don't think. So the big guys are going to be fine. The Facebooks and the Googles and the Zingas and, you know, all those guys that are, you know, doing millions and tens of millions of dollars a year in revenue. And the single guy who is doing it as a hobby and some extra income on the side and just one person is fine. I think where I'm concerned is the great app development companies and developers that I see that are, you know, 5-10 person shops.
Mm-hmm.
I see them potentially going away. And I don't, ultimately, that concerns me, because a lot of those shops are making some of the apps that are some of my favorite apps. And I just don't know how they sustain their business. And it's interesting. It's just an interesting thing to watch. I don't know that I have any answers. I just have a lot of numbers and concerns.
Sometimes it depends on the brilliance of the programmers, the collective ability of the team, and whether the app gets lucky and presses a lot of hot buttons.
Well,
and marketing.
Marketing is, I think, the key for a lot of developers. A lot of developers probably need to regroup and realize, you know what, the same old models that have always applied to software still apply. And a lot of them are just counting on that, you know, I'm going to have a big hit. I'm going to get one thing out there, make a name for myself, and that's going to sustain my company. And again, that worked 5, 6, 8 years ago, but it's not working anymore. So I think a lot of developers need to regroup and sort of reinvest. And, from the consumer side of things, I think, too, both app developers and consumers need to start to look at ways to increase revenues. And right now it seems to be in-app purchase and subscription models And those aren't two of my favorite models. So I'm totally willing to admit my bias in this case.
Well, I'm with you there, Adam. I'm not real a big fan of those either.
You know, I would rather pay $10-$20 for an app that I really love and use and do that every couple years as opposed to have to pay $3 to $5 a month or $2 a month for a bunch of these apps. My wallet just can't take it, to be honest. And it sounds like a minor thing because somebody might go, well, if you're paying $2 a month for an app, you're paying $24 a year. And you're saying you would pay, you know, $20 one time. Yeah, but I might use that app for 18 months before I upgrade or longer and sort of being forced. And I understand why developers have reached this model and it makes sense for them. But I'm not sure, again, in the short term, I think it's working for a lot of developers. In the long term, I don't know that that is going to be all that sustainable for anybody other than, I think it just pushes the divide further, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Because the store can't go on forever. Keep getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and if you're going to have a successful subscription thing, it's harder for when it's a little one-off tool. You know, when it's that cool little photo filter app that is on your phone that you really like. Well, when it comes down to, hey, I need to cut $2 a month from my budget. I have Photoshop. I can kind of do that stuff with Photoshop, and I'm already paying, you know, $60 a month for Creative Cloud. I guess I'll just let that little one go. But a lot of the innovation happens on that little side. And so I'm worried that we're going to lose some of that.
All right. Another topic that I would love to just keep going on with, but I've let us run over, so we're going to have to wrap up. Adam, thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Fun. It's
always great to have you here. And John, thank you for being here.
You're very welcome.
And listeners, I know we did not resolve the whole conundrum that app developers are facing. I'd love to know what you think. You can send me emails. That would be observations@macobserver.com. You can let me know on Twitter. That would be @TMODaily. And of course, you can always leave comments in the show notes. So thank you for being here and joining us again today. We'll see everyone tomorrow.